This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in on this holiday weekend. On today's program, as we look ahead to next year, we're going to look into the past. I have a very special guest joining me momentarily. His name is Mr. Carl Lane. He is the author of A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. I will then, on the second segment of today's program, talk about the economic autumn season and winter season that occurred at about that same time and draw some very important parallels to today's economy. As you know, here at the Everything Financial Radio program, we believe that economies and markets move in cycles, and by studying these cycles historically, we can learn a lot about where we're going today. So I think you'll not only enjoy my conversation with Carl Lane, but also the second segment of today's program. On the last segment of today's program, we're going to talk about stock market forecast for 2015. You know, there's a number of banks that have issued their market forecasts, and many of them are bullish. There are others that have issued very bearish forecasts. So the question we're going to consider in the last segment of today's program is, who do you believe and what strategies do you consider implementing in your situation? And I'm going to be giving you some specific things for you to consider and think about. Quick reminder before I get to my interview with Mr. Lane, we do have a new retirement rules class coming up on January 24. It'll be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. Go to newretirementrules.com to get more information. The website, newretirementrules.com. I'm very pleased to have on the Everything Financial Radio program today Mr. Carl Lane. Carl is a professor of history at Felician College in New Jersey. He received his Ph.D. in history from their Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His articles have appeared in William & Mary Quarterly, Virginia Magazine of History and Biography, and other publications. His book, very interesting to me personally, is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. So we're very pleased to have you on the program today, Carl. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Carl, tell us about the premise of your book, and it's interesting that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Andrew Jackson, who I believe was the seventh American president, was the last American president to actually be in office when there was no national debt.
Well, that's correct. If you don't count Van Buren's first few months in office, we enjoyed debt freedom from January the 1st, 1835. Until October of 1837, when the economy crashed. And in that two-year and 10-month interval, we had no national debt, and it's the only period in our entire history since 1776 when we have been debt-free. And I think very few people are aware of that, and that's one of the reasons why I undertook to write this book.
So talk a little bit about the facts and circumstances that existed at the time and why in our nation's 200-plus year history that there was a period of time that being debt-free was actually a priority.
Well, it was a priority because the revolutionary generation feared public indebtedness as a threat to individual liberty. And they had that view because of the history of public indebtedness in England during the 18th century. And they witnessed, as some folks in England did, that the balance of power between the kingship and the House of Lords and the House of Commons had been undermined by the British national debt, and consequently, when Parliament began to tax Americans or tried to tax Americans, the view was that this was simply going to export to America the evils of the system in England, and as Bernard Balin at Harvard University has argued, that was the logic of the American Rebellion in the first place. And so to make a long story a little bit shorter, the revolutionary generation and the founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 wanted to create a system of checking and balancing, which they did, but they worried that the outstanding debt would play into the hands of people who would use power to undo the checking and balancing system. And it turned out that John Quincy Adams, by advocating the kind of program that he did, without committing himself to debt freedom, undermined his own administration. And I should have just said one last thing. President Monroe, in his last annual message to Congress in December 1824, told Congress, and in effect the whole nation, that barring any national emergency, the debt would be paid on January the 1st, 1835. And Congress committed itself to following that schedule. Adams, as president, seemed to ignore that element of American concern, and the result was that he wound up creating or fostering an opposition that emerged as the Democratic Party.
So we are chatting today, if you're just joining us, with Carl Lane, and Mr. Lane's book is A Nation Wholly Free, and I would encourage you to check it out. I think it's available at all the normal places, Amazon, I'm assuming, Carl?
Yes.
And I
and
encourage
Barnes & Noble, yeah.
Okay, terrific. You know, I would, let's go back. A couple things come to mind. First of all, 2 years and 10 months, we had a nation that was debt-free. Talk about what caused the country to then begin to accumulate debt. I know you mentioned at the beginning of this segment it was the panic of 1837 that kind of set it off, but maybe give the listeners some of that background.
Well, sure. The elimination of the debt wound up, of course, creating a surplus. And the question of what to do with the surplus never got the kind of attention that eliminating the debt had received. And the consequence was that there were a number of different proposals regarding what to do about the surplus. Now, I argue in the book that the obvious thing to have done was to choke off the surplus by sharply reducing the tariff. But Congress did not do that, and that was partly because the compromise tariff of 1833 very quickly became sacrosanct. And even a guy like John C. Calhoun, who was in favor of free trade, refused to tamper with the compromise tariff. So to make a long story a little bit shorter, there were proposals to spend the surplus down on defense. That went nowhere. There was an effort to sell the public lands and a portion of the money back to the states. But in the end, with less than one month of debate, the Congress decided to distribute the surplus to the states. On paper, that is, in the law that did this, the distribution was characterized as a loan, and that if the federal government needed the revenue, then the states would have to return the loan. But in marketing the bill, members of Congress who favored the distribution told other members verbally that this was really a giveaway and that the government of the United States would never recall the loan. Now, this was a bad way to do business, and Andrew Jackson objected to it. But in the end, Congress passed the bill, and the president signed it for a variety of reasons, even though he did not like the legislation. and the distribution went into effect at the beginning of 1837. The money was then given to the states, which deposited the check, so to speak, in state banks that were already holding Federal Reserves, and the banks began to issue loans very, very easily and ultimately created an inflationary situation, which ultimately resulted in a crash in the economy. By October of the 8th of 1837, when President Van Buren called a special session of Congress to deal with the crisis, he did not, nor did any of the members of Congress, recommend recalling the distribution. And that would have been the wise thing to do also, because the crash resulted in a diminution of federal revenues. And since the government's money to operate itself was in short supply, Van Buren wound up borrowing $10 million, and we've been in debt ever since then.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free, and we'll continue our conversation with him after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. We will continue our conversation with Mr. Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free, in the next segment. You know, in this segment, I want to expand on something that Mr. Lane spoke about in the last segment, and we'll talk to him more about it in the next segment. He made a statement that paper money leads to price bubbles. And I believe when one studies history, you can quickly come to the conclusion that this happens time and time again. If you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that we believe that economies move through cycles. In fact, we call these cycles seasons. And these seasons or cycles are closely related to something that we call the currency money cycle. If you listen to last week's program, you know that there is a difference between currency and money. At some points, currency and money are the same thing. At some points, paper money with no link, paper currency, I should say, with no link to something tangible, would be used in commerce, and that's the situation in which we find ourselves today. Well, when paper money is being used and paper money is abundant, an autumn economic season emerges. Now, we would say that the last economic autumn season occurred from 1982 through 2000. And when paper money is abundant, price bubbles inflate, because a lot of paper money means that there's going to be easy credit. Now, this cycle repeats itself time and time again. In fact, a lot of folks that have read the book New Retirement Rules, which is my book that was released about 3 months ago, or those that attend the New Retirement Rules class, are surprised to learn that this autumn season debt accumulation cycle and price bubbles, followed by a winter cycle during which debt is purged from the system, has occurred time and time again throughout history, and three other times in U.S. history. And one of the reasons I wanted to have Mr. Lane on the program today is that his book, A Nation Wholly Free, talks about the fact that when President Andrew Jackson was president, the nation actually had no debt for a period of time. And it was about that time that the economic autumn season turned to an economic winter season. Now, when you look at what happened then, there's a lot of similarities as to where we are today. In fact, if we look at this autumn cycle that occurred from 1821 to 1836 and look at the circumstances that existed at the time, it's very similar to the circumstances that we find ourselves in today. The second central bank of the United States, which was really the Federal Reserve of its time, was chartered in 1817. And at that time, the country was dealing with massive debts that were accumulated during the War of 1812. The second central bank, like today's central bank, the Federal Reserve, printed money. Then after the bank's charter wasn't renewed, state and regional banks were allowed to issue currency or paper money. That resulted in even more easy money and more widely available credit. Now, as I've already mentioned, without widely available easy credit, the system cannot reach its capacity for debt, and asset price bubbles cannot form. However, in the economic autumn season of the 1830s, as a result of this easy credit, a real estate bubble formed and subsequently burst. Speculators abounded. It was a typical autumn season asset bubble fueled by easy credit. Now, look at what's happened more recently. We had the tech stock bubble, and subsequently we saw that tech stock bubble burst. We saw the real estate bubble burst, and shortly after that we saw stocks correct. And we believe and are of the opinion that today's market levels, we saw the Dow reach new nominal highs recently. We believe that that is largely due to the fact that we have asset price bubbles that exist again today. In 1837, as a result of these asset price bubbles bursting, the country, the United States, went into a depression. Now, if you take a look at what the circumstances were leading up to that depression and the panic of 1837, you saw that land was selling at remarkable levels. In fact, from 1834 to 1836, there were 37 million acres of land sold, and by 1836, sales were 10 times greater than they were in 1830. In other words, in 1836, there was 10 times as much land being sold as there was just 6 years prior. That's an asset price bubble. Well, it was a period of speculative mania, not unlike the real estate market recently and the tech stock bubble recently. And the federal government tried to stop it. And as Mr. Lane said, they made a law that said, now if you want to buy land, you have to use gold and silver to buy land. You can't use the paper currency. Well, that's really what triggered the winter season where debt had to be purged from the system. In fact, if you look at what happened in the 1860s, we find this whole cycle repeated itself again. National banking acts were passed into law to allow paper currency to be used along with gold and silver. Asset price bubbles built and burst, and those asset price bubbles bursting ended with the Long Depression of 1873. So these cycles repeat themselves, and Mr. Lane certainly has done a terrific job in his book, A Nation Wholly Free, explaining the facts and circumstances that really surrounded this first transition from an autumn cycle to a winter cycle back in the 1830s. You know, we believe that those who don't study history are going to probably repeat a lot of the mistakes that have been made in the past. And if you haven't studied history and taken a look at how traditional asset classes like stocks and bonds have tended to perform historically speaking in these cycles, we would encourage you to check it out. Most folks use this one bucket approach when it comes to managing money, and it is our view that that approach could fail some folks moving ahead. That's why we do offer some additional resources. The resource that I would encourage you to check out is our one-day class that we're holding on January the 24th. The class will be held, as I said, January the 24th at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information, or you can register for the class by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. The cost for the class is just $49. That $49 is for you and a guest. That covers the cost of all the class handouts. You'll get the book, New Retirement Rules. When you register for the class, you'll have a chance to do some reading ahead of time to make the most of your experience. And the $49 also covers the cost of lunch for you and a guest. The class begins at 9 a.m., concludes at 2:30 p.m. It is an information-packed day. You'll be out by mid-afternoon, and if you're thinking about setting a New Year's resolution to maybe get another perspective on how to manage your nest egg, this can be a terrific resource to help you out. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to check it out, and again, I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free, when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am chatting today with Carl Lane. He is a professor of history at Felician College in New Jersey. He holds his PhD in history from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and he is the author of A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, you know, you had mentioned, Carl, in the last segment that from 1825 to really 1835, that 10-year time frame, that Congress committed themselves to the elimination of debt. That Congress certainly sounds a lot different than the Congress a lot of people are familiar with today. Can you comment on just the makeup of Congress at that time?
Well, in the period after the War of 1812, the Federalist Party disappeared as an institution in American political life. And so there was only one party, the Jeffersonian Republican Party, and they simply agreed that debt had to be eliminated, and eliminated as promptly as was possible. And so in 1817, they enacted the Redemption Act, which provided a formula for the elimination of the national debt over the next, 20 years or whatever that turned out to be. And so there was consensus among the members of Congress. In fact, they didn't even have a roll call vote on the Redemption Act. They just passed it without that kind of parliamentary formality. Adams, as I said, he seemed to be out of step with Congress on the debt matter. And when Jackson became president, everybody knew his view on the national debt, and he remained committed to eliminating it, and he did.
So would you?
There's one other little point here, if I may.
Please.
One of the things that struck me during the research on this project was how very, very similar, once the political opposition emerged to challenge Adams, how bitter the partisanship quickly became. And the kinds of exaggerations and distortions of the truth that characterize a lot of what goes on in our Congress today characterized the Congress back then. And I was recently telling somebody that, you could take some of the speeches from the 1830s and put them into the mouths of people in Congress today. It is just remarkable. And the fact that it seems like nothing has really changed over all of these years.
Well, we have a philosophy that faced with the same sets of facts and circumstances, historically speaking, collective groups of politicians tend to behave similarly. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
You know, let me jump in, because is to what extent would you say that Andrew Jackson, as the president, deserves credit for getting the nation to a point that it was debt-free? He gets a lot of credit historically, but how much of it should he really get?
I think that he deserves the credit that he's gotten, because even though Congress passed the Redemption Act in 1817, it required an executive who was going to remain committed to a program that led to the elimination of the debt in 1835. In fact, he was during his first term in office, he was hoping to eliminate the debt in 1833. Well, things happened, like the nullification crisis in South Carolina, that got in the way of that. But come 1835, the debt was in fact eliminated, and his commitment to eliminating and why he deserves credit has to do with his his vetoes of internal improvement projects, the refusal to recharter the Bank of the United States, and other matters that he could have taken a different position on, but which, if he had, might very well have thrown the Monroe schedule for debt freedom out of whack. So I think that he deserves the credit that he is accorded, because he provided leadership in a way that most Americans at the time apparently respected.
So our guest today, if you're just joining us, is Carl Lane. His book is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. I would encourage you to check it out. To what extent, Jackson didn't like the central bank very much either. In fact, he was responsible for, really spearheading an effort that had the second central bank of the United States, yesterday's version of, or that version of today's Federal Reserve. So can you comment on that? I've read some historical accounts that, you read about Nicholas Biddle, the chair of the Federal Reserve. You can almost insert Janet Yellen's name into that.
Yeah, the bank matter was a problem for Jackson. First of all, he distrusted banks to begin with. He had as a young man, an unfortunate experience with debt to a bank. And the distrust that he had of banks in general really focused on the Second Bank of the United States. And the bank had been created in 1816 for 20 years, and the charter was to expire in 1836. Well, the question came up early in Jackson's term about whether or not the bank should be rechartered. And Jackson gave many a warning in his annual messages that he was not pleased with the present operations of the bank. One of the principal functions of the bank was to make the payments on principal and interest on the national debt. And so as the debt got pared down and heading to zero, Jackson saw a little point in supporting a recharter, since one of the bank's major obligations would have been discharged. He also felt that the effort by Nicholas Biddle and Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams and others to get an early bill to recharter the bank passed in 1832 represented an effort on the bank's part and his opposition's part to confront him with the danger of losing the 1832 election if he was going to put the nation's economy in danger by vetoing the bill. Well, Andrew Jackson was not one to be intimidated. And as he told Martin Van Buren, the bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it. And he did. And when he vetoed the bank bill, he did not know how Americans were going to receive the veto message. And here's another dimension of Jackson's leadership. You know, there were no public opinion polls back in those days, and so he didn't know when he vetoed the bill if he would be making more enemies than friends. But committed as he was to a vision of a debt-free nation, which would provide assurance to American liberties, he went ahead and vetoed the bill, and the bank, of course, never recovered.
So, Carl, can you talk a bit from the the dismantling, if you will, of the Second Central Bank of the United States through the Panic of 1837. Can you talk a bit in the 3 minutes or so we have left, to what extent monetary policy led to the Panic of 1837?
Well, the bank, of course, its charter ended in 1836, and the bank reorganized as the Bank of Pennsylvania, as opposed to a national bank. And it, like other state banks around the country, wound up receiving distribution funds under the Distribution Bill of 1836. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, that revenue going into state banks wound up being loaned out by state banks to land companies, which were looking to invest in the public lands. Under the law at the time, the federal lands in the western states could be purchased at $1.25 per acre. Well, everybody knew that there was Western expansion, and so land companies bought up the public lands at the minimum price in order to sell to incoming settlers at a profit. But once they did that, the money was returned to the different banks and then loaned out again. And according to Jackson, this was inherently inflationary. The bubble in the price of the public lands was burst by Jackson himself in late 1836 with the so-called specie circular. The specie circular simply required that any public land being purchased had to be purchased in gold and silver coin and not in paper money. And the consequence of that was to, as I said, burst the bubble in the price of the public lands. But it also raised the question among the business community that if the President of the United States could, on his own authority, demonetize banknotes for a particular asset, then could not the president do that with regard to other matters, such as, for example, the tariff? What if tariff payments had to be made in gold and silver coin also? In the end, it turned out that the banks, starting in New York, began to fail because gold and silver assets or reserves wound up heading west to deal with the specie circular, and the law that required them to exchange their notes to gold and silver coin on demand could no longer be met. And so major banking institutions went into bankruptcy. The domino effect throughout the economy was that people lost their jobs. Tariff revenues declined sharply. And as a consequence, the government of the United States didn't have enough money to operate. And so, bingo, we were back into borrowing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating conversation. Our guest today has been Carl Lane. The book is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, Carl, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
We will return after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. And thanks again to our special guest today, Mr. Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free, for joining us today and giving us some really great historical perspective. You know, at this time of year, you always hear pundits and analysts making a 2015 forecast. about where the economy's going and maybe what the stock market's going to look like. And I have a question for you. Whenever you hear a pundit or an analyst make a prediction as to where the market's going, did it ever occur to you that there is at least a reasonable chance that that forecast will be wrong? Let me give you some examples, because in preparation for today's program, I went out and looked at some of the market forecasts that were being made for 2015. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch issued their global research forecast back on December the 9th, and in that forecast, you'll find these words. The Standard & Poor's 500 index is expected to rise to 2,200 during 2015. While we believe the era of excess returns and excessively low volatility is in the past, the secular bull market in stocks should continue. Expected gains in the year ahead imply a price return of approximately 6%. Vanguard also issued their report and forecast, and here's what they say about the global equity market for 2015. After several years of suggesting that strong equity returns were possible despite a prolonged period of subpar economic growth, our outlook for global equities has become more guarded. The expected 10-year median nominal return is below historical averages and has shifted toward the bottom of the 6 to 9% range compared with this time last year. That's a reflection of less constructive market valuations in the United States and some other developed markets. Kiplinger's published an article titled Stock Market Outlook for 2015. The article was written by Ann Cates Smith. This article said, bull markets don't always age gracefully. This one may be entering its golden years, beset by uncertainties and buffeted by cross currents. Toward the end of 2014, a long period of calm gave way to increasing volatility, and you can expect more of the same in 2015 as the sedative of an ultra-easy monetary policy starts to wear off. Later in the article, but for now, the bullish case is not only intact, it's strong. A vibrant stateside economy will provide strong support for U.S. stocks, while Europe's woes will create some compelling bargains. Analysts expect earnings growth in 2015 of 8 to 10% on average for companies in the S&P 500. So three forecasts that are bullish or somewhat bullish for the stock market. Then there was an article published on Bloomberg back on November 11. Here are some words from that article. In 1929, a businessman and economist by the name of Jerome Levy didn't like what he saw in his analysis of corporate profits. He sold his stocks before the October crash that year. Almost eight decades later, the consultancy company that bears his name declared, the next recession will be caused by the deflating housing bubble. By February of 2007, it predicted problems in the subprime mortgage market would spread to virtually all financial markets. In 2007, it saw imminent recession. The slump began 2 months later. The Jerome Levy Forecasting Center, based in Mount Kisco, New York, and run by Jerome's grandson, David, is once again more worried than its peers. Its half-dozen analysts attach a 65% probability of a worldwide recession forcing a contraction in the U.S. by the end of next year. That call runs counter to the forecasts of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. The two banks pose it an expansion that has plenty of room to run. An article in Money News talked about the fact, this was written on December 25 by Christian Hill, and the article talks about the fact that there's overwhelming evidence the next stock market crash could strike any day now, and a growing number of investors are turning to a noted economist to prepare for the unthinkable. The message is clear. Despite the Dow hitting pre-crash highs, companies reporting positive earnings, and the financial media saying we're looking at the beginning of a new bull market, the stock market, at least according to this article, is on the verge of another historic collapse. The article talks about and shows five charts, and obviously on the radio I can't show you the charts, but let me give you the five reasons that this particular author thinks the market will correct. The S&P 500 consensus earnings per share is expected to come in much lower than originally thought, Estimates started out near $125 in January 2012, have now fallen 10% to only $112. Despite the warning sign of falling earnings, the S&P continues to climb. Reason number two, stocks are currently very expensive compared to their 10-year average. While stocks typically have a price-to-earnings ratio of 15, they now sit at a ratio closer to 23. That means stocks are priced currently 53% higher than their 10-year average, which should worry any investor. Reason number three, investors are extremely bullish on the market right now. The bullish extreme measurement is nearing a 10-year high, and most of us know from experience what happens when market sentiment is too far one way or another, a snapback occurs. If the herd is currently this bullish, it's generally a good idea to be very cautious. The fourth reason, the volatility index is near an historic low. As markets have rebounded over the last few years, investors have become complacent. They have priced nearly all risk out of the market, and it will take only one scary event to send volatility higher and investors fleeing the market. And finally, reason number five, the last two times the market climbed this high, a severe correction took place. The first two advances were over 100% and then followed by a crash of roughly 50%. That was the run-up from the mid-90s to the correction that began in 2000, and that was the run-up from the market bottom in 2002 to the market correction that began in 2007. Well, this latest rally from the market bottom in March of 2009 has now exceeded 100%. So, is it likely the market is setting itself up for another drastic correction? So here's the big question. Who should you believe? They can't all be right. The market can't go up by 6% and crash in the same year. So who should you believe and what strategies might you consider implementing? Well, we give you some strategies to consider at our new retirement rules class, and there's another one-day class coming up in the new year. January 24 is the date. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. The information on the class is posted at the website newretirementrules.com. You can get more information about the class, or you can sign up there as well while capacity remains. It is the first class of the new year. We expect that it will fill up quickly. The cost for the class is just $49. That covers the cost of all books and handouts for you and a guest, as well as lunch for you and a guest. So if you've made a New Year's resolution to maybe try to figure out how to manage your nest egg better, this class can offer you some great perspective. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. That's our show for this week. Glad you tuned in. Have a great week.